This program is provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim.
You know, right now, on the incredibly chaotic, incredibly busy border between China and Vietnam, there's a machine quietly replacing human customs agents.
Yeah, and we are not talking about, like, a stationary camera or a simple barcode scanner here.
No, not at all. We are talking about a full-on humanoid robot walking the corridor, independently scanning cargo manifests, making real-time decisions while trying to navigate around completely unpredictable human travelers.
Right. It's wild.
It really is. I mean, the future isn't arriving with some loud cinematic sci-fi movie premiere. It's arriving quietly, wearing a uniform, at the Fengchenggang border crossing.
Exactly. And that quiet arrival is really what makes the data we are looking at today so critical.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at this deeply detailed briefing of real-time data from July 2026. This was provided to us by former lawmaker Kyung-jin Kim.
Right, which is just packed with information.
So packed. And the underlying theme of his entire report is that, you know, we have officially crossed a threshold. Like, we are entirely out of the quote-unquote demo phase.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission for you today is to provide a comprehensive shortcut to understanding this exact moment in time.
Right.
We're going to cut through all the noise and look at how AI, robotics, semiconductors, and, well, global trade are all colliding right now. We'll break down the mechanics of how these technologies work, why they're shifting from laboratory experiments into these high-stakes deployments, and what that actually means for you.
Because, I mean, the ripple effects of this deployment phase are fundamentally altering the global economy.
Yeah, definitely.
It's not just about what a robot can do physically, right? It's about how that robot's mere existence rewires supply chains, hardware demands, and even geopolitical boundaries.
Well, let's start right there at the Fengchenggang border.
Mm-hmm.
The specific machine station there is the Ubitech Walker S2 humanoid robot.
Yep.
And this deployment, it's part of a $37 million contract. Which is huge.
Massive.
The specs on this thing are intense. It's 1.76 meters tall. It features fourth generation hands. They can independently lift 15 kilograms with just one arm.
Which is pretty heavy for a robotic arm.
Right. And it is 52 degrees of freedom. Now, I see that phrase thrown around a lot in robotics marketing, degrees of freedom. But what does a number like 52 actually translate to in the physical world?
Yeah, to put that in perspective, think about your own arm. A human arm has roughly 7 degrees of freedom.
Okay.
So your shoulder moves in three ways, your elbow in one, your wrist in three.
Makes sense.
Right. So when you scale up to 52 degrees of freedom across an entire robotic frame, you are looking at a machine capable of incredibly articulate micro adjustments.
Oh, wow.
It isn't just walking in a stiff, straight line like an old toy. It's dynamically balancing itself if a traveler accidentally bumps into it.
Right, because a border crossing is totally unpredictable.
Exactly. It's crouching to look under a cargo container or, you know, using these highly dexterous fingers to manipulate physical documents or optical scanners.
And doing all that in a chaotic environment. I mean, a factory floor is a controlled space.
Very controlled.
But a border crossing. You've got weather changes, erratic lighting, and just stressed out humans carrying heavy luggage everywhere.
It is the ultimate real-world stress test.
Right. But here's the detail from the briefing that I really want to push back on. The Walker S2 can swap its own battery in 3 minutes.
Yep.
It operates 247, so it's basically executing a Formula One pit stop for Border Patrol.
That's a great way to put it.
But, I mean, is a fast battery swap really the metric that proves we've crossed into industrial reliability? Or is a $37 million contract just, you know, a very expensive, highly visible PR stunt to make the border look futuristic?
What's fascinating here is it would absolutely be a PR stunt if a battery swap was just a neat party trick.
Right.
But the significance of a 3-minute hot swap changes the fundamental math of a supply chain.
How so?
Well, in industrial logistics, a machine that needs to be plugged into a wall to charge for, say, 4 hours a day, that is a massive bottleneck.
Oh, I see. Because it's just sitting there.
Exactly. You literally have to buy redundant robots just to cover the charging shifts of the first robots. A 3-minute swap means essentially zero downtime.
Wow.
And we know this isn't isolated, because if you look at the wider data provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim, Ubitech received 13,361 mass orders for their U-World U1 consumer robot in the exact same week.
Wait, over 13,000 pre-orders for a consumer model?
Yeah, starting at roughly $22,000 each.
That's insane.
It is. And this consumer version isn't just physical, right? It comes equipped with an emotion recognition large language model.
Wait, really? Emotion recognition.
Yep. It can visually and audibly process over 20 different human emotions with 90% accuracy in real time.
Oh, wow.
So when you synthesize these two data points, a zero downtime industrial deployment on a national border, alongside this massive commercial demand for an emotionally intelligent consumer model, former lawmaker Kung Jin Kim's assessment rings incredibly true.
That the timeline has moved up.
Massively accelerated. The timeline for humanoids competing in the global export market is here right now.
But, you know, a robot doing a 3-minute battery swap or reading the frustration on a traveler's face, that is ultimately just a physical trick, unless it has the cognitive speed to match it.
Oh, absolutely.
Like recognizing an emotion or scanning a complex cargo manifest in real time requires AI models that are cheaper, faster, and smarter than what we had even 6 months ago.
Right. Hardware speed is totally useless without software speed.
Exactly. So let's look at how the software is maturing to meet this physical demand.
Well, the software ecosystem is undergoing a massive structural shift to accommodate these exact physical deployments.
We can see that clearly in the software updates extracted from the briefing. For example, ByteDance is gearing up to release CDance 2.5, right?
Yeah, and that's a huge deal.
Which generates native 30-second 4K video with zero stitching.
Meaning the AI isn't just rendering 5-second clips and gluing them together.
Right. It's generating an entire half minute of flawless physics and lighting in a single cognitive breath, essentially.
Exactly.
Then you have Alibaba's Qwen 3.7 Plus, which recently pivoted from an open weight model to a proprietary one. And it is dominating Terminal Bench 2.0. Let's define those terms for a second because they are really crucial.
They really are. So when we say Alibaba shifted away from an open weight model, it means they stopped letting developers download the actual neural architecture, like the brain of the AI, to run on their own local servers.
They locked it down.
They locked it completely down. Now, it is proprietary. You can only interact with it through Alibaba's API paywall.
Right.
And they did this because the model is just incredibly valuable, as proven by Terminal Bench 2.0.
Which is what, like a testing standard?
Yeah, it's essentially a brutal standardized gauntlet where AI models are pitted against each other to solve complex, multi-step software engineering tasks.
So it's basically the ultimate proving ground for AI reasoning right now.
Totally.
But here's where it gets really interesting. You have this shift from open source to monetized utility, right?
Mm-hmm.
And DeepSeek V4 is introducing peak and off-peak API pricing.
This is a huge shift.
It's wild. If you use their AI between 9 a.m. and 12 p.m. or 2 p.m. and 6 p.m., they literally charge you double. It is Uber surge pricing for artificial intelligence.
That's exactly what it is.
So why are we suddenly seeing dynamic pricing in software? I mean, I always thought sending a prompt to an AI costs the same, whether it's noon or midnight.
Well, that is the illusion of the cloud, right? Reality is that running a prompt, what we call inference, requires physical electricity and physical server racks.
Because there's an actual computer somewhere doing the work.
Yes. And this surge pricing is a classic maturation signal. Think about the early days of the electrical grid.
Okay.
Initially, companies just wanted to prove the light bulb worked. But once everyone had a light bulb, the grid faced physical limits.
Ah.
Right. When millions of users hit an AI API at 10 a.m., the data centers physically consume massive amounts of power and compute. The price war, where AI companies basically subsidize those costs just to gain users, that's over.
So they're passing the cost to the consumer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. AI is now a standard utility, and developers are going to have to absorb those peak load costs or, you know, throttle their own users.
And it isn't just the market enforcing this maturation either. It's the government.
Oh, for sure.
The briefing details China's new TC260 AI ethics guidelines. This is a 3-tier regulatory system that went into effect in July. It mandates risk control during the training phase, strict protections for minors, and this is the big one, real-time monitoring for service providers.
Which, by the way, is an incredibly heavy lift computationally.
Right, because how do you physically regulate a neural network? You can't just politely tell an AI to behave.
No, you really can't.
Real-time monitoring means you need a second AI constantly evaluating the outputs of the first AI just to ensure it isn't hallucinating or breaking safety protocol.
Precisely. You're doubling the compute.
Yeah.
The ecosystem is moving from this experimental playground to a monetized, heavily regulated utility.
Yeah.
But implementing real-time monitoring, generating native 4K video, or processing real-world data from a border robot, all of that requires a staggering amount of compute overhead.
It really does.
You cannot run a regulated, surge-priced digital utility without an unimaginable amount of physical hardware beneath it.
Which brings us to the very real, physical choke point of all this progress, right? The silicon squeeze. And the escalating trade war happening right now to secure it.
It's the bottleneck for everything we just talked about.
Exactly. Now, before we get into the recent political and trade moves between the U.S. and China, we want to make it crystal clear to you that we are not taking sides or endorsing any political viewpoints here. We are simply reporting the facts and actions detailed in the original source material.
Right. Our goal is to understand the mechanics of these events objectively.
So looking objectively at the data provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim, the hardware crunch is getting severe. 20 global chip makers, including legacy giants like Infineon and Texas Instruments, are raising their prices by 10 to 25%.
And that's just across the board.
Yeah. And some power management semiconductors have spiked by 85%, purely because AI data centers are consuming so much power.
It's a massive shock to the supply chain.
And in the middle of this, China's SMAC is successfully producing 5-nanometer chips, their N+3 node. But they are doing it using older DUV or deep ultraviolet lithography machines because they are barred from importing the state-of-the-art EUV machines.
Right, the extreme ultraviolet ones.
I've heard this comparison before, but let's break down the actual mechanism for a second. Why is using a DUV machine to make a 5-nanometer chip such a crazy engineering headache?
Well, it comes down to the physical properties of light. Lithography is basically printing a microscopic map of transistors onto a silicon wafer using light.
Okay.
The state-of-the-art EUV machines use light wavelengths that are incredibly tiny, about 13.5 nanometers.
It's very, very precise.
Exactly. This allows them to print ultra-fine, razor-sharp lines at the 5-nanometer scale. The older DUV machines, however, use light wavelengths of 193 nanometers.
Oh, wow. That's a massive difference. So it's basically the house painting roller analogy. Trying to print a 5-nanometer chip with 193 nanometer light wave is like trying to paint a hyper-realistic microscopic portrait using a thick, fuzzy house painting roller.
That is exactly the right visual.
It just smudges everywhere.
Right? Pretty much. You can technically force it to work through a process called multi-patterning, essentially stamping the wide roller over and over again from different angles to carve out a thinner line.
That sounds exhausting.
It is, and the margin for error is astronomical, which is why the briefing notes that SOMMIX yields on these 5-nanometer chips are only between 20 and 40%.
Wait, meaning they literally throw away up to 80% of the silicon wafers they print just because of those smudges?
Yeah, they just go in the trash.
That sounds like a total financial disaster. I mean, if a commercial foundry threw away 80% of its product, it would be bankrupt in a month. How is this a sustainable strategy?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to separate commercial sustainability from sovereign sustainability.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
For a normal business, yes, a 20% yield is ruinous. But for a nation facing a total blockade on advanced hardware, sustainability isn't about profit margins. It's about technological survival.
Oh, I get it.
Right. The domestic demand for any functional advanced chip in China is so overwhelming that it basically subsidizes the massive inefficiency of the manufacturing process.
The cost is totally irrelevant when the alternative is losing the AI race entirely.
Exactly.
And this hardware squeeze is triggering massive geopolitical retaliation. Because the U.S. blacklisted roughly 80 Chinese firms to restrict their access to this technology, China's Ministry of Commerce just retaliated. They added 10 U.S. firms to their export control list and banned 46 from government procurement.
And these aren't just random administrative targets either.
No, not at all. The list includes Oshkosh Defense and, crucially, MP Materials, which is a massive rare earth miner.
And rare earth elements are the foundational ingredients for, well, every piece of technology we've discussed today.
Literally everything.
Yeah. The magnets inside the 52 degrees of freedom on the Walker S2 robot, they require rare earths. The high-capacity wiring in the AI data centers. Rare earths.
Right.
By targeting MP materials, China is pressing directly on the primary supply chain vulnerability of the U.S. tech sector.
It's like a completely interconnected board game.
Yeah.
Which leads us to what might be the most fascinating part of lawyer Kyungjin Kim's briefing. The unintended consequences of trying to control this ecosystem.
Oh, yeah.
When you enforce a ban, you create a vacuum. And in technology, vacuums get filled instantly.
Let's talk about the Anthropic Fable 5 incident.
This is a perfect case study in how XTOR controls can backfire.
So an Amazon research team discovered a jailbreak vulnerability in Anthropic's new Fable 5 AI. basically a way to bypass its safety guardrails. They reported it, and the U.S. government immediately halted the export of both Fable 5 and Mythos 5 for about 2.5 weeks, just while Anthropic scrambled to patch the code.
Which sounds reasonable on paper, right? Right, but 2.5 weeks is an absolute eternity in AI development. During that exact window, China's GLM 5.2 open source model hit the market and absolutely exploded.
It was crazy.
CNBC even called it a, quote, gift to China, because global developers who were locked out of the U.S. models during that pause immediately downloaded the Chinese model, which rivaled U.S. frontier capabilities.
Yeah, remember our discussion about open weight versus proprietary models a minute ago?
Yeah, the API paywall stuff.
Fable 5 is proprietary. When the U.S. government paused its export, developers were physically blocked at the API level. They couldn't access it.
Right.
But GLM 5.2 was open source. Anyone, anywhere in the world, could download the weights directly to their own local servers.
It's like a coach giving their star player a mandatory 2-minute timeout to tie their shoelaces, only to watch the opposing team score 3 massive game-changing goals while their player is just sitting on the bench.
That's a painfully accurate analogy.
Right. But my question is, now that GLM 5.2 is downloaded on hard drives across Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, how hard is it to put that open source genie back in the bottle?
Honestly, it is physically impossible.
Really?
Yeah. Once an open source model is released and decentralized onto local servers, no government mandate can delete it. Developers will fine-tune it, build applications on top of it, and just integrate it into their businesses.
Wow.
And this highlights a profound paradox detailed in former lawmaker Kingjin Kim's commentary. Export controls are originally designed to protect U.S. technological dominance.
That's the whole point of them.
But by locking down access, they actually force international developers to find alternatives, which ultimately erodes the market share of U.S. companies.
The briefing actually points out that NVIDIA's market share in China's AI chip market has already dropped below 50%, which is wild.
It is.
When you restrict a massive market, they don't just, you know, politely stop developing. They build expensive, low-yield alternatives like the Semikai 5-nanometer chips. Or they pivot entirely to open-source software architectures that completely bypass U.S. bottlenecks.
The controls literally act as a catalyst for the exact self-reliance they were intended to prevent in the first place.
So what does this all mean? If you are a nation that is in neither the United States nor China, you were just caught in the crossfire of this massive technological decoupling.
You're stuck in the middle.
Yeah. You are watching prices for chips skyrocket, open source models flood the market, and Border Patrol robots enter active duty. Which brings our focus directly to South Korea and what can only be described as a $500 billion gamble to survive this era.
Yeah, South Korea's position is arguably the most complex of any developed nation right now.
The briefing details an announcement of a massive 800 trillion won investment that translates to roughly 518 billion U.S. dollars.
$500 billion.
Led by Samsung and SK Hynix. And South Korea is attempting to build 4 new megafabs, focusing entirely on memory chips, physical AI architecture, and data centers.
And this is where lawyer Kungjin Kim's analysis of the situation really zeroes in on the true vulnerability.
Because it's not the money.
Right. Right. He points out that the sheer volume of capital, $518 billion, is undoubtedly enough to compete on the global stage. It is an astronomical war chest. The vulnerability lies entirely in the timeline. The target for these megafabs to be fully operational is the mid-2030s.
A full decade from now.
Yes.
And this is where the physical reality clashes violently with the software reality we've been talking about. We just discussed how AI models can leapfrog competitors globally in a 2.5-week window.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Planning a hardware strategy that matures in 10 years is like trying to build a massive, complex concrete dam to catch a river. But knowing the river's path is going to radically change course 3 or 4 times before you even finish pouring the foundation.
That's exactly the risk.
How does South Korea survive this intermediate decade? I mean, if those domestic Chinese chips rapidly eat up the regional market share before these Korean megafabs are even built, won't the market be entirely consolidated by the time they open their doors?
This raises an important question, and it's the definitive challenge of what analysts are calling the 10-year gap.
Okay, the 10-year gap.
Because building a state-of-the-art semiconductor fab isn't just about having the money. It requires years of environmental impact studies, navigating international supply chains to secure highly backordered lithography machines from companies like ASML and, you know, constructing these immaculate clean room environments.
You can't just throw money at concrete to make it dry faster.
Exactly. You cannot software patch a physical building into existence.
So they have to walk a tightrope for 10 years.
A razor-thin tightrope. Economically, South Korea relies heavily on the U.S. for defense and advanced tech partnerships, but they rely just as heavily on China for export revenue and raw materials. So during this decade of construction, they have to navigate the 10 to 25% global chip price hikes, which heavily impacts their consumer electronics giants.
Like Samsung's phones and TVs.
Right. And if they lean too far into U.S. export controls, they face severe economic retaliation from China. But if they bypass those controls to maintain their market share in China, they risk getting hit by devastating secondary sanctions from the U.S.
That's lose-lose.
All while just praying that their $500 billion infrastructure bet will still be relevant to whatever the AI architecture looks like in 2035.
It is an almost incomprehensible balancing act.
Mm.
So let's pull all of these threads together and synthesize what we've discovered today.
Sounds good.
We are watching a fundamental structural shift happening right in front of us. We are seeing humanoid robots with 52 degrees of freedom leaving the testing labs to take over 247 physical labor at international borders.
Incredible to see.
We're watching the software brains powering these machines transition from experimental open source projects into highly profitable, surge-priced, and strictly regulated utilities. And as the physical compute requirements to run these systems just skyrocket, nations are locked in an intense battle over silicon lithography and rare earth minerals, leading to these massive $500 billion bets on infrastructure that won't even exist for another 10 years.
Yeah, we are witnessing the incredibly messy, highly expensive process of abstract mathematics basically becoming physical infrastructure.
The demo phase is officially over.
Yeah.
And the deployment phase is completely rewriting the global supply chain.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on that exact tension between software speed and physical reality.
Okay.
We talked about South Korea's 10-year timeline to build their mega fabs. That decade represents the absolute physical limit of human bureaucracy, material supply chains, and concrete construction.
Right. It's just how long things take in the real world.
But AI models are exponentially improving their cognitive capabilities every few months. So what happens to the global economy when the pace of AI advancement completely and permanently outstrips our physical ability to mine the materials, pour the concrete, and build the hardware required to actually run it?
Wow. That is a staggering thought to end on. The software just outrunning the concrete. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the realities of our immediate future. Keep asking questions about the technology around you. Keep looking past the sci-fi marketing and stay curious. We'll catch you next time.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.